sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The G20 sees excessive risk-taking in markets, while the IMF wants more stimulus. Alibaba's IPO opens with a bang, and we see enormous volume on this quadruple witching on this Friday. All this and much more on episode number 381 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And no, you didn't have anything wrong with your device. You had nothing wrong with your iTunes or any other way that you get this particular podcast. I took the week off. It was one of the weeks where everything was just converging. I finally moved, got the office moved some time ago, got the house moved. We just moved in, all the finishing touches. And I got to tell you that last few days of making sure that everything was just in place and moving and getting things from over there to over here, boy, if you moved, you know what I'm talking about. It's rough. I mean, I had so many decisions to make in those last few days that I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do a podcast. And I thought it'd be better to wait a week, take a rest, kind of sit back, look at what's going on, and then come back with some important things that we are discussing here. I spent this weekend up at UCF. My son goes to college there, and he's pledging in a fraternity, Theta Chi, and it was quite the interesting family weekend. We had all sorts of fun. Fortunately, the UCF football team won their first game. They were 0-2 coming into this week, and they won with a pretty wide margin for success. I think it was 41-7, I think it was, the final score. But it was a fun time if you have the opportunity to spend some time with your kids at family weekend up at school, especially if they're freshmen. You know what I'm talking about. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Anyway, thanks for being patient with me. And thanks for all the emails that you sent me. You can always send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All right, so what's going on and what do we have to talk about? Well, let's start off with the G20. There was a great article out this last week, towards the end of the week, over the weekend. There's some information that expanded the information on what they were talking about. But the group of G20 financial chiefs and central bankers, they had said, hey, you know what? That low interest rates are contributing to a potential increase in financial market risk as major policymakers rely on monetary stimulus to bolster growth. Duh. I mean, this is not news. This is obvious. And we know that there has been an increased amount of money that has been flowing into the developed markets, in particular into the U.S. markets. We know that even with negative news, we saw that the leading indicators on Friday were much lower than expected. Some manufacturing gauges better. Some employment numbers, of course, we saw last week were better. But at the same time, we also saw that the raw numbers underneath some of this, like on the durable goods, on manufacturing, on factory orders, et cetera, and even on new housing starts, were not as good as what were expected. But meanwhile, markets didn't seem to care. Investors don't care. They're just buying into everything that they can. And what's really fascinating about this is that the G20 and the IMF are a big part of the efforts to increase stimulus. In fact, they went on to say that we are mindful of the potential for a buildup of excessive risk in financial markets, particularly in an environment of low interest rates and low asset price volatility. These are the officials from the G20. And they said they welcome the stronger economic conditions in some key economies, although growth in the global economy is uneven. Now, they went on further to talk about how, well, you know, there's risk from shadow banking and it's growing fast. And this is what Christine Lagarde had talked about. And while she said that central banks have tools to react to potential excessive valuations in various parts of the market, it was countered by Bundesbank President Jens Weidmann. He said that an environment of low interest rates can threaten financial stability. and investors are becoming complacent about risk in financial markets. And that was from the Financial Stability Board back on September 18th, just last week. And markets, of course, in the emerging area, the emerging part of the world, were hurt last year on the prospect of a reduction in U.S. stimulus, and that spurred outflows. And the concern now is that, oh, well, listen, you know what? We're not achieving our 2% number that we had set out to do, and that was based on some of the increased stimulus that was coming from various parts of the world, inclusive of Europe. But yet, we do see a lot of risk. Although, we think it should continue. We want to have more growth. We want to have a continuation of efforts by central banks and monetary policy that will help markets around the world, because really the fiscal policy isn't doing much in the major world economies. And they did say also that the G20 economies will continue to implement our financial strategies flexible to take into account near-term economic conditions while putting debt as a share of GDP on a sustained path. We agree to consider changes in the composition of quality of government expenditure and tax to enhance the contribution of our fiscal strategies of growth. So on one hand, they're complaining that, hey, you know what, we know that there's a lot of risk-taking going on, and that could really be problematic. And they're even talking about some of the derivative moves and some of the things that are happening inside of markets, the excess of risk-taking that is going on due to the fact that there is excess liquidity in the markets and low interest rates. On the other hand, we don't care. It doesn't really matter because we think we can handle it. And in fact, what we're going to do is try to press those economies to continue with their various efforts in order to stimulate growth for the future. So what's really going on here, and I really think is fascinating, and why I bring this up, is that we know this complacency, right? We know that generally speaking, and complacency doesn't necessarily have to be bad, by the way, but this complacency in that there is really no thought that any kind of risk will really hit markets, and with good reason, because it hasn't. We have seen time and time again markets coming in a bit, and then some announcement. For example, last week we had China coming out with an $81 billion effort to infuse money into banks after they're having all sorts of liquidity problems due to the fact that their housing market and their real estate market is really imploding on them. But you know what? Even though they realize that they want to shut this down or they want to close a lot of the loopholes and the problems with their property markets, what they do? They came into the rescue once again of the banks. In other words, nobody fails. There is no real open market. There is real no true market-based principles that are being applied right now. And it is training investors to believe that there is very little, if no risk at all, in investing. Take, for example, Puerto Rico, you know, basically going defaulting and going into bankruptcy. Detroit, doesn't matter, because even with all that, investors are gobbling up the debt of those states, even with the fact that there is excessive potential for risk involved in that. Take, for example, Argentina, Venezuela. It doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to register, because at the end of the day, governments are going to, even though they default in some circumstances, they're going to continue on their plan to just provide as much liquidity no matter how much it's going to hurt in the future. And I say all this not to spook you and not to say, hey, you know what? Markets are at a peak that are going to drop and you're going to see a 20 or 30% like some players are talking about right now. Even some are talking about a 60% drop in equity valuations and equity values in major markets and emerging markets around the world. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that smart investing requires some cautious attitude toward, and respect, frankly, towards the markets, because we have seen so many times that just our own central bank is so far off of their own expectations. They continually come out with their expectation of a date and forward-looking when things will happen, when the unemployment rate will reach a certain level and what they'll do, and what the economy will grow at in any given quarter or in a year. And for the most part, they're wrong. It is so hard to actually project and to provide an accurate assessment, because of the moving parts that are involved out there. You have, for example, the United States now is on a path to somewhat reduce down the stimulus, and that's why we see 11 weeks of rising U.S. dollar valuation. And I want to talk about the U.S. dollar in a second, because I got some questions about that last week. But we see that 11 weeks in a row, we're seeing a rise in the U.S. dollar, probably about a 5% rise against major currencies on the DXY, the package, if you will, of the dollar against other currencies. And that doesn't seem to be affecting things. If we saw the same thing happen in Japan, for example, the yen rising in value, it would be a catastrophe to exporters. What we are seeing is the yen hitting 109. It's a price level that hasn't been seen in a very long time, years. And that in itself is helping along the Nikkei and helping along their exporters, helping along their economy, even though there's a flight of money out of the country. There's been a flight of money out of China. And where's all that money going? It's going to what is assumed to be the safest place in the world. It is going into the U.S., and it's going into it hard. We're seeing a tremendous uptick, and that's, by the way, the bottom line of where all this buy the dips are coming from. It's not individual investors. Come on, there's not that much money that is sitting on the sidelines that people are looking to invest at these valuations. No, it's not the hedge funds. It's not necessarily the mutual funds. It's investors from outside the U.S. that are taking money from their country, and that's why in the last number of weeks we're seeing that those currencies are going down, and they're taking them out and they're putting them somewhere else, and they want to be invested in equity. So what are they doing? They're putting them into the U.S. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that answer a lot of questions? I mean, you can't tell me you weren't scratching your head and saying, you know, where is this money coming from? Where is the constant bid for assets in the U.S. coming from? Well, it's coming from outside the U.S. There's a tremendous amount of money that's flowing in. It could be flowing in from sovereign wealth funds, which are basically, we'll call it the hedge funds of countries. Countries have all sorts of money amassed to invest on the behalf of the government in order to create money so that they can spend on their particular needs, whether it's infrastructure growth, whether it's to offset lower taxation revenue. Whatever it may be, in their particular instance, they have these sovereign wealth funds. And what they're doing is they're investing in stocks. They're investing in real estate in the U.S. China has been plowing so much money into U.S. real estate over the last year and a half or 2 years. It's incredible. And the companies like the Lennars, the KV Homes, Humvavians, and even the non-publicly traded companies in the real estate area, like the REITs that may be not non-publicly traded or the publicly traded REITs, are getting a tremendous amount of money, and that is helping. And that's good, by the way, because it's helping to prop up that industry. It's helping to prop up liquidity, the ability for them to reinvest, to expand, etc. And that's also why we're seeing such an incredible move in the multifamily housing. One of the big things that we're seeing is, yes, single-family housing has been doing better. It's healing the market. Overall, is doing well. But the addition of multifamily dwellings over the last 6 months or so, maybe even a year, I'll go back that far, has been really growing dramatically. Look around your neck of the woods and see what's going on in terms of how that growth is happening, and watch the buildings that are going up, the apartments that are going up, the condos, the rentals. Really quite incredible. I'm here in South Florida, and it's just unbelievable. Almost in every corner, there is something being torn down, and a very significant amount of multifamily type of dwellings is being erected. Construction is doing well. You see the cranes. Actually, you'll see where you have cranes, you know that's probably either going to be office buildings or it's going to be multifamily, because I don't know about you, unless you have some very wealthy people out there with very large houses that are building, probably they don't need cranes to build their homes, right? So what's happening is that there is this influx of money that is coming in from overseas, China, Japan, Europe, and what's happening, and even emerging markets, and it's going into things like real estate. They like real estate as an investment. It's going into stocks, and it's going into our bonds. You know, if we look at the amount of bonds that are not being purchased by the central bank, by our central bank, because we went from $80 billion down to about $10 billion of monthly bond purchases in treasuries. And yet as that's occurred, we've been seeing that the yield has generally been coming down. Yeah, it did spike up a little bit last week, but generally speaking, yields have been coming down, meaning that more people are buying bonds and putting money into it, and the principal value is going higher, and thereby that is creating lower yields overall. Now, with that, you have to ask again, where is that coming from? If there's a real good idea that our economy is growing, well, why are people buying bonds? Shouldn't they be putting more money into stocks? Yeah, okay, yes, they are. But aren't they also doing a great deal of purchases of bonds? Well, who is, again, where's that money coming from? It's foreign money. Now, I don't expect that foreign money will just fly out of here very quickly and will just destroy the whole market environment and create a problem with equities. But I will tell you this, and I've been talking about this for the last 3 or 4 weeks now, a couple of things. First of all, there is an interesting move in some of the commodities that are underlying the markets right now. We saw that copper had been selling off and then kind of popped up a little bit, but still seeing some problems. And I must tell you, to my incredible surprise, even though I did see the dollar coming up a bit, gold and silver have been absolutely getting hammered. Talk about a downtrend. It's almost like every day they're whacking gold and silver. Silver was down about 3.5% on Friday itself. Gold was down about 1%. I talked about a number of weeks ago, maybe about 2 months ago, how I thought that, hey, you know what? It would make sense to put a little bit of gold and silver in the portfolios right now, because it would seem that, you know, all things being equal, where they're seeing higher valuations on stocks and bonds, that, you know, really they're getting a little less attractive at this point. Where else are people going to put money if they don't want to be necessarily in cash? Well, they may look for the commodities. We saw oil just get absolutely hammered for a number of weeks. We saw that, again, gold and silver just keep on coming down. And by the way, if you haven't noticed, many of the miners have been getting absolutely obliterated lately. So far I've been terribly wrong on the gold trade. I must tell you, gold and silver, I'm not giving up on it just yet. We see some support that is kicking in here. But I got to tell you, that move on Friday, which may have been due to some of the quadruple witching of options that occurred on Friday with enormous volume across the board on equities and on all asset classes throughout the day. You start out very hot, ended very hot. I would say that there is a good amount of traders that are bailing, but yet at the same time, I want to back up in one point, and then we'll get to this dollar discussion. I think it's very interesting that they have been selling off as much as they have, gold and silver. And I was wondering, why is that happening? So I'm speculating a little bit here, and I'm kind of going out on the limb. I'm wondering, is it possible that with all of the illiquidity, the problems that we're seeing in Russia due to the sanctions that are being put on them because of all the things that are happening with them in the Ukraine, that there is this just absolute drought of liquidity? Their financial system is pretty much seizing up. They don't have any access to outside funds. And I wonder if Russia is selling a lot of their precious metals to unload them, to create liquidity so that they can have some availability of funds to fund their various markets. Because as you look at what's going on in Russia, you know, there's a big problem there. In fact, there was a commentary out by Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev just over the weekend. And he's urging emerging countries to conduct transactions in national currencies and bypassing the cross rates with the United States dollar, U.S. dollar. And once again, this is something that we've seen before, that Russia and a few others like China have try to move away from the U.S. dollar as the standard currency that we trade against for many different commodities. The commodity-based countries don't like this. Don't forget, as we see the commodity-based countries like Australia, China to a degree, and also Russia, some of the emerging markets as well, those countries that have a lot of natural resources and utilize them for their country's overall financial health, valuation, and tradability, when the U.S. dollar goes up, it really hurts them. And what we see is when that occurs, that those countries have a lot of problems. And on top of that, with all of the sanctions that are being imposed on Russia right now, I think very easily there is a clear and very understandable concern on their part that as the dollar goes up, their currency, which is their commodity, their commodities go down. And that really caused them problem. Now, Russia is saying that they can easily make mutual settlements directly. And these are mechanisms that could benefit both sides of a transaction. And they said also the sanctions have created a bad situation for Russian banks in the financial markets because basically all sources of liquidity are now frozen. And they're saying that this is from the Russian prime minister. He says, it's a senseless and ugly decision towards Russia, but they believe they can manage without it. Again, I think what they're doing is they're probably going and cashing in. Now, what happens if things settle down a little bit? What happens if, in fact, maybe there's some kind of peace accord or maybe the sanctions are lifted even though they've been seemingly getting worse by the day? New things have been added on a regular basis. But, you know, we talked about a number of times that the more sanctions that are added, the more it's going to end up kicking back and being bad for example, Europe and the United States and other countries that are imposing this because it's a two-way street. Trade is two ways. So I think that when we do see that and watch this, that if you do see gold starting to move up due to the fact that maybe there is some kind of a lifting of sanctions, this may be a time to move back because we may see that that seller, the big seller that could be, again, I'm speculating here, I'm totally speculating on this, that the seller of Russia into this situation to create liquidity for themselves could be lifting. Just a thought. Now let's talk about the dollar for a second. Now one of the things that I got a question recently about the U.S. dollar. And the question was, hey, Andrew, listen, how do we get a rising dollar? Like, how do I buy the dollar? What do I do? Well, here's something we need to know. When it comes to currencies, currencies are only traded against another currency. So as opposed to a stock, so when you buy a stock, for example, it's trading at $20 a share, and you go and you buy it, and basically what you're doing is you're buying that stock from someone else, of course, that is setting a price of what they're willing to sell it for. And when you get that, it's just a simple transaction. Somebody's selling a stock, somebody's buying a stock, somebody's selling a stock at 20, 21, whatever the price is, you decide, yeah, I'm buying that. That's the worthwhile valuation of what I'm willing to pay for that particular stock. Bond is the same kind of thing. Now, when we look at a currency, we only value a currency against another currency. So the dollar itself is not a tradable instrument necessarily, even though there is something called the dollar index, which you know trades at a particular level. But let's take a look at the dollar index and think about what it is. It's a component of the valuation of the dollar as compared to other currencies. So they're called currency pairs. Now, there's one caveat here, which we'll get to here, and mention that you can purchase a future, in the futures market, of a currency. So you can buy, for example, the euro. It's EC something or other, depending on the month and the strike price of what it is, or the valuation of the date. You can purchase the yen, JY, and the date, etc., when it expires. And similar to kind of an option, same kind of pricing mechanism. But the futures, same thing. You can buy the S&P futures or Nikkei futures or whatever other future. But when we talk about currencies themselves, they're traded in pairs. So, for example, when you look at the yen and the yen is at 109, we compare that to the dollar. How many dollars will buy yen or how many yens will buy dollars? It's a relationship. It's a ratio, if you will. So when you're looking at the valuation, and the question was then, well, how do I determine? Somebody says, you know, I want to buy the U.S. dollar against the Canadian dollar. Or I want to buy the yen against, the Swedish krona. Or I want to buy the euro against, let's say, the yen. Well, how do you decide that? Well, currencies will usually move in a direction of the strength of an economy, usually. As an economy strengthens, their currency will usually rise as well. Now, this is without Fed or central bank intervention, without political issues, etc. We're talking about just the valuation of a currency theoretically should move in tandem with the strength of an economy. The underlying economy strengthens, so should that particular currency. Against another currency of another economy that may or may not be stronger or weaker. So, for example, If we look at the fact that the Japanese government just downgraded the overall economic situation in Japan, and we also look at the fact that basically we're seeing that it's a stronger economy in the U.S., what we should see in theory is that the dollar versus the yen should rise. That makes sense? Well, if that's the case, then you want to buy dollars against the yen. The same thing is the case with Europe. If you want to buy the euro or sell the euro, you may want to do it against the dollar. And if you do so, you want to do it in a conversation of the relative strength of one economy versus another. Now, of course, we have to these days enter into the whole conversation further with, okay, well, what is the central bank doing? Now, if we see that the central bank in the U.S. is going to be taking their foot off the pedal a little bit because the economy is strengthening, remember, that's why they would do so, right? If they're going to maybe, let's say, for example, they're going to immediately raise interest rates, the dollar is probably going to go stronger against those particular currencies of countries that are still in a stimulus mechanism process. So what will happen is that we're going to look at, for example, the euro. We know that the ECB has talked about recently how they're going to continue to, you know, reduce interest rates and increase their deposit rate to force money out of the euro out of the central bank and into the street. We know that they talked about asset-backed security purchases. And when you look at that, that's all a weakening situation because of a deflationary environment in the euro region. And right now, that means that the European region is weakening. Maybe it will strengthen, but it's weakening. And that's why there's a lot of people that have been buying dollars and selling euros in that pair. So just remember that currencies trade in pairs. And we look at this, we look at how a currency is going to be performing against other, considering things like the economy, interest rate factors, and what central banks will do. Of course, we have political issues also. So you may see, for example, if there's political strife and possibly some kind of underlying problems in the government of a particular country, you'll see that their currency will also start to move lower. Now, when it comes to the dollar index, called the DXY, the Dixie, now you can buy this, by the way, in an ETF, but what you're going to do is you're going to get a mixture. The Dixie itself is a conglomeration of several different currencies, the yen, the euro, a few others, against the dollar. So when you look at the Dixie at 84, let's call it, 84 and change, and it's been rising from 80, so it went from, call it about 5%. When you see that happening, that means that the other currencies have been generally weakening against the dollar. So that's what you see all the time when you look at, if you look at CNBC or Bloomberg or Reuters or Yahoo, when you look at the dollar value, it's against a basket of currencies. All right, now that we got that out of the way, hopefully you'll be able to check that out. You can look at any of these values. You can look at the DXY spot, again, which is a basket of currencies, mostly against the euro, by the way. About 50% of it is the euro that is compared against. But that will give you an idea of how that works. And again, you can utilize, I think it's UUP, is a symbol of the ETF that will actually buy that for you if you want to be in long on the dollar. All right, let's take a look. I want to talk about the ECB for a second here, because just to finish off with this whole discussion of central banks and what's going on with the dollar, what's going on with different currencies. It's interesting because there's a lot of controversy over this whole bond buying program. If you remember, we've talked about this whole idea, and we talked about it with Das, and we're going to bring him back very shortly to talk about this more at length and to get a little bit more detail and some more discussion on this. But the ECB has talked about this asset-backed program of buying these bonds of asset-backed securities, and they want to do so to create some kind of a quantitative easing program, a quasi-quantitative easing program. And even with that announcement and knowledge that it's not really a quantitative easing program, it's kind of QE light or whatever you want to call it, it has a lot of controversy inside the ECB itself. Now, here's the thing. It's confusing. But just this weekend, Christian Neuer, who is an ECB governing council member, said that the ECB is not planning to loosen its stability policy or to buy government bonds. Now, this is coming on the heels of what was discussed about the potential for quantitative easing by the ECB about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he says that there's really not that much deflation in the Eurozone, which, again, it goes into contrast of what we're seeing. And while the Council agrees that low inflation is dangerous if it persists because it hurts the ECB's credibility and limits the range of actions it can take, he says that the asset-backed security program is really a problem. And one of the problems is that you need to make sure to qualify and to quantify the loan securitizations before any purchases, not just do an outright purchase. One of the other things that was talked about was somehow, amazingly, even against the bylaws and all of the actual contracts and constraints of what the ECB could do with their funds, because remember, it's not just one country. It's a conglomeration of many countries that put all this money together. Is what are they going to do with that money that they have stocked up? Can they actually purchase the bonds of various countries? And so far, they haven't done so. They've done it differently. They pushed money into the banks, and the banks actually bought the bonds. And that's why you're seeing that the yields on, you know, Italian and Greek and Portugal and Spain, all the bonds of those countries, the yields have gone down to record lows, even though there's still a lot of risk over there, even though there's deflation there, even though they're really not healed and there's still some problems. We just saw what happened with the Portugal bank recently and all the problems they're having there, and still seeing a lot of continuation of the problems they had due to all of the real estate overbuilding and problems with extraordinarily high unemployment in that area. The whole region, you know, 10-11% still persists in the entire Eurozone. And it's a lot higher in Spain and Portugal and Italy. So I just think it's really interesting that this confusion over these ECB actions and what's going on in that area. But we'll continue to watch that and bring on Das to give us a little bit more of a definitive understanding of what's going on with that. So stay tuned for that. Let's talk about Yahoo for a second. Alibaba came out with their IPO on Friday. It was priced at about $68 per share. Then it was initial opening interest was in the 70s, 80s, and then it opened up in the 80s and went to about 97, 98, and dropped down to about 93. It came down to about 90 at one point, a little bit lower than that, actually, and then closed about $93. Alibaba, which is, we'll call it for lack of a better discussion, a high-level shopping experience type of site where they do bidding for you, and very interesting. Go check out their site, Alibaba, and they do most of their business with China. China basically has an implicit backing of the company. They created it with Jack Ma. And five or six years has created this just mammoth company with incredible amounts of revenue and profitability. Now, there's a lot of different investors inside of this, early investors that had big stakes. You had SoftBank and you had Yahoo. Now, I find it very interesting about what's going on with Yahoo, because the valuation of Yahoo, if you take a look at the core valuation, the capitalization rate of Yahoo, and you compare that to their value of their holding of Alibaba, it's approaching the fact that Yahoo is essentially, as a company, worth almost nothing if you take out the Alibaba component. Very interesting. Now, we know that even with all the change that went on with the new CEO, and we know that with all of the closings of many of their various different company components and kind of closing it up and making it much more streamlined production, and again, all the things that happened, that there was a lot better overall process that was going on. But at the same time, a lot of the valuation that was being pegged to Yahoo was due to the fact they owned this nice chunk of Alibaba. So the question is, what's going to happen? On one hand, we could say Yahoo probably would look like a company that, with now the unlocked valuation of Alibaba, could see some additional interest in buying. Because if you look at it and you say that the company is worth nothing, that's ridiculous, of course, you know, if you extract Alibaba. But on the other hand, you want to say, hey, you know what? There could be an opportunity there, because if Yahoo does anything right, they're going to have not only the value of Alibaba, but the underlying value of the company itself. That's one thought. The other thought is that now that Alibaba is available to invest in and you can unlock the value of Alibaba from Yahoo, why not just take the money from a loser and take the money out of Alibaba's position, or Yahoo, let's say, and move it into Alibaba? So why sit around with a company that there is a lot of, you know, we're very unsure about? The clarity of what the real valuation of the company is questionable. And if we were holding on to it only because we want to have a piece of the Alibaba stake, and we know that we're getting it at a really good price, and we're riding the coattails of this whole Alibaba wave, why not just take the money out of Yahoo and move it right to Alibaba? Now, that makes a lot of sense to me. Why stick around with the losing horse when you know there's a winner out there? At least a winner in terms of what we see as their growth of revenue, growth of earnings, the potential for this company. And on last week's DH Unplugged, I suggested that maybe it would be a good idea to look at shorting Yahoo into the IPO for Alibaba. And as it turned out, when the IPO finally came out, Yahoo was down about 3%, 2.5%, 3%, even more at the low for the day, but it closed up a little bit from there on Friday. And I do really wonder how many players are going to be just dumping their stake now that we have the valuation known and now that we know what these numbers are and the access to Alibaba in the open market is available. Why not? I mean, what's the risk at this point? The risk before was that you would lose out on the benefit of any of the upside of Alibaba because it was not unlocked. It was not traded. It wasn't out there. But now that it is, think about it. Does that make sense? Got a lot of questions that came in to me. Again, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I got a lot of questions that came in and said, you know, what do I do with Yahoo at this point? I don't know. I think if you don't want to short it, that's fine. But if Alibaba is going to be anything like any of the IPOs we recently have seen, it may be something worthwhile. You know, I mentioned that I'm still short in the TDIMG portfolios, the managed growth strategy portfolios that we manage for clients, and that's available for you as well. We mentioned that we are short Pollo Loco, L-O-C-O is the symbol, because the valuation is just out of control. Now, meanwhile, it looks like, again, we're starting to see the same kind of thing happen where hot money is going to be rotating. We saw that Loco was up a number of days. There were some upgrades. And then all of a sudden started flattening out and rolling down. Down again Friday, Thursday, I believe Wednesday it was down as well. I think that what we're seeing is a very, very typical rotation of hot money, momentum money, into the next hot idea. So now that maybe Loco has seen a little bit of the momentum shift, there's going to be continuation of the pullout of the value of those that made some nice money in it and rotate into, let's say, Alibaba. There's a lot of concern out there by many professionals that the vast size of Alibaba, the potential exposure they have, the PR, etc., and the opportunity that is presented may actually drain some of the liquidity of many of the social media and technology funds, stocks, that are out there right now and may in fact start to show some signs of weakening in markets that are on the momentum side, because now what's going to happen is you're going to want to see that you get the next hot thing. You want to make sure that by the end of the quarter, you're going to see, which is, you know, coming up very, very quickly, that there will be a lot of money managers who want to have Alibaba on their books, and they're going to take money out of some of the positions where they made some nice money towards the end of the year and shift it. So keep a watch on that. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out over the next number of weeks and months in terms of where the hot money is flowing. Now, while we're on the topic of stocks, I had mentioned FireEye, F-E-Y-E to you. One of the things that has been in the spotlight of late is hacking. The Home Depot situation, which now has been set to exceed the hacking that happened and the stealing of customer information, it has eclipsed the Target debacle. And what we're seeing is a very targeted and even a custom-made process that has been used over months to steal information from shoppers at those facilities. Now, we see it at Target. We've seen it at many, many different retailers. We've seen it at now Home Depot in extraordinary level. And I had mentioned that it would be very interesting to see some of the companies that are involved in security, particularly FireEye, that there may be an opportunity to invest in them. Now, that was when it was about 30, 31. The range of this stock, which I think is very interesting, is in the about $30 range, about 31 to about 36. Now, it's been playing in between there. It kind of moves up, then it comes back hard, and then moves back up. We've kind of been investing and actually sold our position on Friday. We had a basis of about 31, sold it on average about 35. But I think this is something that can be watched very carefully and look at the range. And if it does get down to the 31.5 range, it looks like it's a good buy. It seems not to be able to get past this 36 level. It just seems to be stuck, you know, on a closing basis. Just gets there and kind of just starts moving back down and then gets there and moves back down. So what we've been doing is we've been playing the range. And if you're trading and if you're looking for different ways to trade, there's a few different ways to do this. First of all, the opportunity to trade within a range of a defined consolidation where it will go up and down, in and out, kind of buy on the downside at a very defined support level, and then to sell at a defined resistance level is always something that can be beneficial. Now, once you get to that resistance level, what you want to do is you want to look for if it does have, you know, momentum, if it has a lot of volume behind it, if it sees a big move to the upside, whether it's because of an upgrade, whether it's because there's a lot of shorts that are being squeezed out, if there is some kind of a new breakthrough. They did come out with an announcement last week that they're going to be doing they're going to be starting to look at doing a different model where they're going to be doing a subscription service, which is very interesting. Markets weren't thrilled with it. But yet, if you play the range, look for 31 to 35, 35.5, 36. If it pops over 36, it could be a major short squeeze coming on. But right now, the momentum seems to have faded, comes in very quickly and goes very quickly with this stock. But down about 31.5, 32 to about 35.5, 36 is that range that you want to play inside and out. When it gets to the 36 range, what I like to do is you take half your position off. And if it does break above 36 and change and it goes to 37, hey, you know, add back to it at that point. Because then if you do see that break, it can be very violent to the upside. There's a few other companies in this sector, Symantec, there's Palo Alto Networks. But I do like FireEye because it is showing a consolidation that may be able to show some kind of a rip on the upside if, in fact, there is the opportunity that finally the companies are going to put a lot of money into security, because the reality is that they can no longer be subject to these kind of hacks which are going to steal customer information, because customers are going to get very pissed off. Now, the Apple iPhone that came out that may be able to create some biometric and additional security in terms of payment systems may be a really good way for us to have at least a little bit better security when it comes to the security of our information. But again, where there is a way, the hackers are going to find a hole, they're going to find a flaw, they're going to find a way to kind of sneak through the firewall and the walls and all. But if maybe some of these security companies can come out with a definitive product of some sort that can really do something, or at least enhance the potential for security, I think that there's going to be a lot of money spent by these companies, because what they want to do, like the Home Depots, the Targets, etc., what they want to do is they want to at least, number one, create the at least the consciousness that, hey, you know what, we're doing something, we're proactive, we're looking to close up these loopholes. The second thing is that they want to actually make sure that this doesn't happen again. So they want to at first at least do the PR, look like they're doing something, and of course these companies that are in the security area may in fact be the beneficiaries of a lot of that maneuvering, so that there can be a new and a better level of comfort, confidence, and security overall when it comes to using our credit cards. Remember something, years ago, you would go into a restaurant and there would be a lot of people that wouldn't want to give their credit card information to the waiter because they were concerned about it. You know, now that's okay. That's fine. We just give our credit cards away at any given time. We swipe it in a store all the time. We put it on the internet. We give people the expiration date and the, you know, the security code all the time when it comes to paying for things. And, you know, we don't want to get into a situation where we're having to worry about that, because that could really be a major problem when it comes to sales. Cash isn't used that much. You don't walk into a store and pay $300 and just whip out cash. You're probably using credit cards or checks. And now if there is a concern that is rising over the security of credit cards and fraud, then you know what's going to happen is people are going to spend less, and companies like the retailer aren't going to want that. I mean, that is not going to be good for their bottom line or for, you know, anything that goes along with what they're doing. So I think that you have to really be very conscious of the whole process here of what's going on in terms of the shift to online buying, the shift to utilizing credit card, and on top of just the credit card companies utilizing all the security they can, there has to go through one step to get there, right? So when you swipe your card, and while it may be secure on the side of the credit card company, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, whoever it is, the fact of the matter is it goes through another process to get there. And if that is broken down in the case of what happened here on Target and Home Depot and how this information was hacked and stolen, that's a big problem. So keep your eye on the security companies and put those on your list of areas, because that, I think, is going to be something that can be very, very profitable for the long term if they can get this right. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Make sure to get this on iTunes and tell your friends about it. Any questions you have about the strategies, whether the global allocation strategies, the Arrow, which is a pretty cool strategy for in, out, or neutral on the S&P 500, or if you want to look at the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check it out. All the information is there. Just click on all the different details, and you can find out more about that. We're going to have Das. We're going to have Frank Curzio and all your favorites coming up in the next few shows. Thanks for joining me. And again, I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.